We'll call the meeting of the Property and Local Sales Tax Division to order. Good morning. And we have a couple pieces of business this morning. First off, though, Representative Barrett, do you want to introduce the pages
Madam
that
Chair,
are joining
thank you very
us?
Much. I would love to. We have the high honor of having our student pages here this morning, members and citizens. If you wouldn't mind, pages, standing up, embarrass yourself a little bit by giving your name and where you're from and maybe who your representative might be. And the girl in the purple in the front row to the right, if you wouldn't mind starting, that would be great.
Aww, that's cute. Nice going.
Okay, my name is David Heidi, and I'm from Michael, and my representative is Martin.
I'm Brad Burke. I'm from Bank of Heights, and my representative is Beth Stoll.
I'm Hannah Fonten. I'm from Chatsco, and my representative is Joe Hockey.
I'm from DC. I'm from Edina.
I'm Joey Delft, and I'm from New Orleans, and my representative is Paul Brothers.
I'm Dick Richardson, I'm from Jasco, and my representative is Ernie Whitaker.
Great. Thank you very much.
You.
Nice to
Thank
have you,
you
here. Okay, we do have a quorum. We'll offer the minutes for approval. Representative Lemire, do you want to approve the minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how about Representative McDonald? Do you want to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Sure, as long as I can make sure I was here. Yes, I'll make a motion to approve the minutes. They seem very accurate.
Okay, minutes have been, the motions are made to approve the minutes. Any discussion? If not, all in favor say yes.
Madam Chair.
Aye.
Oh, Representative Wardlow.
I'm indicated as having been present and excused, so I would move that.
All right. Thank you, Representative. We'll make that notation.
Okay.
So the minutes stand approved as corrected. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Minutes approved. Okay. Very good. We're going to start. There's sort of one piece to the big property tax puzzle.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just, you know, in this committee, we do a lot of talking about cities and counties and their well-being and the revenues and expenditures, and I know we're going to be talking about local government aid and reform and so forth. So, you know, statements made about cities and counties are very important in here. And what I would like, and I'm looking for some clarification on a quote, Madam Chair, that you made on the House floor back last Wednesday when Representative Ward asked you how many cuts in jobs would House File 130 mean for cities and counties? And you answered back that that in fact the private sector had lost 161,000 jobs. And then you went on to say, quote, government in Minnesota lost none, all right? They've been spared the pain, unquote. And then you went on and talked a little bit further about cities and counties needed to begin to look at where they were spending their dollars, and we had to examine and look inside what cities and counties were spending. So, you know, and your comments carry weight. And that's why I thought I'd wait till this meeting to ask for the clarification. So I guess when you said there were government in Minnesota lost none, were you referring to all state government? Were you referring to all local government? Were you referring to non-education local government, which would be cities and counties and special districts? And where'd you get that information?
You want to? I can get you the information. Columnist in the Star Tribune, Eric Wiffering, and his reference was to all Minnesota government. So I'm making a broad statement.
Okay, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. But, you know, I think the reference was, in most of your comment, you were talking about cities and counties. And I think here are the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And, in fact, from depends on what time frame you look at, but from 08 to 10, the private sector lost 4.6%. And from 08 to 010, and by the way, I'm averaging the 010 numbers because they have all the months, but there might be a little bit of adjustment. So I'm just I'm using 010. This is
right.
from Deed and the latest statistics that on local governments, this is non-education, which was cities, counties, special districts, from 08 to 010, it was a loss of 1.1%, a loss. Now, if you go from 06 to 010, the loss in cities and counties is minus 2.8%, loss of about 4,300 jobs. But if you really go back to when I think probably the recession began for cities and counties, and that's when the state began to have budget problems and began to cut local government aid and county program aid, from 02 to 10, the loss in jobs for cities and counties is 5.0%, 7,793 jobs. In that same time, private lost 0.6%. I think we have to make it very clear that, in fact, cities and counties have been feeling the pain. And I wanted the clarification of what you were talking about, because you weren't talking about cities and counties. I guess you were talking about government overall, even though Representative Ward's question was how would House File 130, which dealt with cuts to local government aid, would affect. So I wanted to clarify that. But it gets to one other point I want to make, Madam Chair, is why are we pitting private jobs against public jobs? Why do we pit the private sector against the public sector, which I've heard a lot about? The private sector needs the public sector, and the public sector needs the private sector. And when both are strong, the state is strong.
In the right proportion.
And when you look at the recession, things are a little different. The private sector, based on demand, consumer demand is going to go down and you're going to see a loss. But actually, during a recession, public services, the demand may increase. We know that in cities, for example, when the recession hits, crime doesn't go down. They actually say crime may not go up, the stats, but domestic abuse increases, mental health concerns increases. That may not show up on the stats, but increases public law enforcement. During a recession, it doesn't snow less. During a recession, there are not less fires. And so I don't understand, you know, so this constant comparison and I guess bashing of the public, I think hurts all of us. And, you know, I don't think you heard people in the public sector when jobs were being lost from 02 to 07 complaining that jobs were increasing in the private sector during that very same time. And, you know, I remember being at a midnight Christmas mass and the beepers going off from the volunteer fire department in Dilworth of the firemen who were at church that night having to leave at that point. So I guess the point is, I think this whole discussion and some of your comments bothered me on the House floor because I don't think it gave the full picture. And I guess what I would like, you know, is, you know, when you put things out there as a chair and you're referring to cities and counties and you've clarified that you meant government overall, even though the whole context was around cities and counties, that when we talk about things in here that we make sure that we're giving a fair picture, because if we're going to have an honest debate, and we've got huge, huge issues we have to deal with on the budget and the whole works, while we can earnestly disagree, I think that we need to come to the table with accurate facts and an accurate premise in which to begin. And when we pick and depict boogeymen out there who we want to attack, that hurts the process. And Minnesota is going to be a better state if the private sector is strong and the public sector is strong. And we should not be ever, ever pitting one against another, because each needs each other for a prosperous state and a prosperous future for all of us. And so I appreciate your clarification, but I wanted to set the record straight in that fact. Cities and counties have suffered pain just like the private sector has.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt, and I hope you'll take your own words to heart. Thank you. And now we're going to hear from Mr. Michaels. TIF is a tax increment financing is an area we haven't touched on. It is a big piece of the local property tax subject matter, so we'll take about 20 minutes and get an overview of tax increment financing. So, Mr. Michaels.
Madam Chair, thank you. Joel Michael from House Research, and I'll try to do a very quick overview of tax increment so that you can get on to the main event of Green Acres. What I plan to do is to do basically five things, which you can see on this slide, to go over. Basically, what is tax increment? How do the TIF mechanics actually work? What types of tax increment districts are there? The but-for test, which is always a big thing because it's one of the key elements to sort of make sure that TIF is used appropriately. And what can cities use tax increment revenues for? A couple of other things that I'll get to at the end that are not on this slide are the 2010 jobs bill provisions, which had a couple of special exceptions for TIF that last for just a two-year period. I'll talk about those. And finally, I want to talk about how TIF differs from economic development abatement, which is another program that's often used for the same purpose. So to go through first, what is tax increment financing? In general, tax increment's a way of dedicating the increase in property tax that results from a new development and using that increased property taxes as a financing tool, not to pay for the cost of general government, but rather to help finance the development itself or related public costs of the development. In Minnesota, tax increment is used basically by cities and development authorities. Development authorities are things like economic development authorities, housing and redevelopment authorities, and community development agencies. There are two purposes that tax increment is used for in Minnesota. The first thing is sort of the classic economic development. You're going to use it to encourage private business to develop real estate that they otherwise would not develop or redevelop. The second thing is that tax increment is used to pay for public improvements. And in Minnesota, this is one of the things that's a little different in the Minnesota tax increment law from many other states. Sometimes those improvements are unrelated to the development that's being induced, because the Minnesota law, as I'll talk about a little bit later, allows you to collect increments from one development and then what is called pool and use that increment elsewhere in the city. So how do TIF mechanics work? How does it really work? As I said before, TIF captures the taxes on the growth in tax base that's caused by certifying a TIF district. So before the development occurs, the city draws a geographic area that's the TIF district, and the assessor and the county auditor together will certify the current value of that geographic area. So what's the tax value of that area? And that term in the law is called the original tax capacity. At the same time that they do that, they also certify the tax rate, the local tax rate that's in effect. In the old days in this case means before 1988, it used to be that this feature was not there. And as a result of that, the capture involved not only the growth in tax value that occurred because of the development or the change over time, but also if the local governments raised their tax rate, that also generated increment. In 1988, the legislature said, no, we don't want that additional tax to go to tax increment. We want that to go to general government. So that's at the point at which we started certifying the original tax rate. So if you take the current value of that geographic area and you subtract out the original tax capacity, what you get is the captured value. And that's the value that will actually generate the increment. And the tax increment, this is the revenue that you can use under the law, is equal to that original tax rate multiplied by the captured value. So that's the sort of the simple algebra of the program. Now, as you think about it, you can realize that most of that is because a new development occurred. So you built a new building, that generates more value, but it also captures inflation. So if general property values go up and the captured value goes up, that gets captured as well. So it's not just the development alone, but it's also inflation that gets captured. So what types of TIF districts do we have? And it's, the type of district is important for, I think, three basic reasons. One is it will limit where you can create a district, because each of them has separate rules that say, well, where can you draw the geography of this district? And if it's one type of district, if it's an economic development district, one set of rules applies. If it's a redevelopment district, you have to find blight, etc. So it's important as to where you can draw it. Secondly, how long you can capture this incremental tax. And three, what can you spend the money on? This slide shows the different types of districts and the duration limit that applies. So you can see on the short end, economic development districts where there's no blight requirement, there's an 8-year duration limit, whereas the districts that have blight or that have other special rules like hazardous substance or redevelopment, they can go on for 25 years. The but-for test. This is something that's, you know, typically talked about. It's, you know, as the this is not a technical term. It's not used in the statute, but it's the way legislators and policymakers refer to it. Would the development happen if you didn't use tax increment? So, but for the use of tax increment, this development wouldn't have happened. And so the idea is it's okay, it may be okay then to use tax increment because we're causing something to happen that otherwise wouldn't have happened. Now, the important thing is it's basically a finding requirement. So the law puts it up to the city to make this judgment. The municipality in this case is almost always a city. There's a few county districts and there's a few town districts, but it's mainly cities. This test only applies at the very beginning, so it's when the city creates the district that they have to make this but-for finding. And it's based on the city's opinion. And that's what the law is very clear, so that there isn't litigation about the but-for test. In theory, you could litigate it, but the law, you'd be litigating about whether the city has an opinion or not. There are two components of it. The first one is the one I stated, obviously, that development wouldn't have occurred without tax increment. But then the second thing is they have to also find that this development will increase the value over what would have happened absent that. So under the old test, it was you could just find this specific development wouldn't happen. Under this reformulated test, this was reformulated in the middle 90s. They would also have to say, well, this property also maybe would have developed for some other purpose, but the development that we're assisting will provide a bigger increase in value than that other development would have. What can a city use tax increment revenues for? Typically, a typical use is to buy the land and prepare the site for development. So that may be involved demolishing existing deblighted structures, putting in sewer and water, and that kind of thing. They can also use it for adjoining streets and road improvements and so forth. Very typical thing is that they will write down the land. So they might buy the land for $1 million, but then sell it to the developer for $1 or $500,000. And that difference between the cost of the city and what they sell it to the developer for is typically referred to as a land write-down. There are only limited kinds of things that they can use for private improvements. Housing is the main exception, and there are other ways that they can sometimes use it for private improvements, but usually it's for site preparation and site acquisition and land write-downs and not to build private buildings. So what can't they use tax increment revenue? Basically, the general rule is if you can't find a permitted use in the tax increment or the Development Authority Acts in combination, then you can't use it. and there's an explicit prohibition. You can't use it to build government buildings. So you, in the early 80s, there were some cities who were using tax increment to build city halls, and the legislature in 1982 prohibited that. And you can understand the reason why, because these incremental taxes are not just taxes of the city, but they're also taxes of the county, the school, and so forth. And so we felt that that was inappropriate. And as I said before, most private buildings can't be used for it. This graph shows the percentage of tax base that is captured in tax increment over the last 30 years, basically. You can see that the Tax Increment Act that provided this general authority passed in 1979, and over time there's been, you know, quite a bit of growth. The legislature in the late 80s and the early 90s restricted tax increments, so you can see it sort of reached a peak after, right after those restrictions were imposed, and then it was flat during the 1990s. With the 2001 change, that was a big change in the property tax, where essentially the school general ed levy was repealed and the state general tax was imposed partially to replace that. The key thing was that the general ed tax was captured, but the state general tax is not. And so that's why there was a big drop. Some of the drop in the later 2000s is finally some of the restrictions in the 90s taking effect, and then the drop in the real estate market, you can see it at the very end. This graph shows the dollar amounts of tax increment revenue over time. You can see that, you know, basically it's been fairly flat, and again the ups and downs of the real estate market show up in this graph as well. This graph shows how the numbers of districts are divided among the different types of districts. You can see the redevelopment is by far the largest category of districts with 48% of the total. Housing is second at 28%, and economic development is at 20%. Before the legislature dramatically restricted the uses of economic development districts, they were a much larger percentage. In the early 90s, that you would, I think you would go back and find that they were closer to 40% in those days. This graph shows the amount of tax increment debt bonds that are outstanding. One of the things that cities have started to do since the 80s and consistently been doing more is that they're issuing less of their own explicit debt and relying more on what are called pay-as-you-go obligations. With a pay-as-you-go obligation, the developer basically finances the obligation with its own money. So the developer will go out and borrow and pay for these costs, and then the city will reimburse the developer for those costs. And so it does it. Those obligations don't show up on this graph, and so this trend down in part reflects the fact that more financing is being done by developers. There are a lot of limitations on how you can use tax increment, and when cities come in later in the session for special bills, you will find out more about this, because they will want exceptions from various of these rules. So I've listed them here. The four-year rule requires that if you have a parcel in a district, you got to have some activity occur on it or adjacent to it within 4 years after you approve the district. There are restrictions on pooling. This is the ability I referred to before to collect increment from the geographic area of the district, but then spend it elsewhere in the city. It used to be that you could do that with no limitation. The legislature in 1990 put percentage limits on that. So for a redevelopment district, you can only take 25% of your increment and spend it elsewhere in the city but outside of the district, and for economic development districts it's 20%. There's a five-year rule that says you have to complete your spending within 5 years after you certify the district, and after 6 years all you can do is pay down debt and contracts, and otherwise you have to pay to decertify. Just quickly want to talk about two things that were done in the jobs bill. One thing that was done was that the economic development district rules were opened up to allow it for any purpose. Under prior law, it could only be used for manufacturing, warehouse, and R&D. These were thought to be sort of the footloose kind of industries that could go to another state. The jobs bill said for an 18-month period, just to stimulate construction in Minnesota, we'll let economic development districts be used for any purpose. These are like the old rules. The second thing the jobs bill did was to suspend the rules on pooling so that things could be used for more purposes than traditionally is the case with tax increment. Both of these provisions expire this year, and I think you will see proposals to extend those. There's a separate program called Economic Development Abatement, and it's an alternative to using TIF, and it's used for basically the same kinds of purposes to encourage development and so forth. The key difference between abatement and tax increment, there are really a couple of key differences that are outlined here. They can be used for basically the same kind of purposes, but abatement can be used for more things and is more flexible. But each of the taxing districts has to approve the abatement. With tax increment, only the city approves, even though they're capturing the taxes from the school and the county and the special taxing districts as well. With abatement, each of the taxing districts has to approve if you want to capture or use their taxes. So the school would have to approve for its taxes, the county would have to approve for its taxes, and the city for its taxes. The duration limits for abatement are typically shorter than for tax increment. It's usually 15 years, and there's a lot more flexibility on what you can use the money for. This slide just goes through the permitted purposes, and this slide compares the sort of the different rules under the two programs. If you want more information on tax increment, our website has what I call a TIF primer that has a lot of detail on all of these restrictions. So I think if you printed it out, it would probably be 50 pages long. So if you want to get, but you can click through and get to the various different things if you want to look at it. The Office of State Auditor, which is the entity that's responsible for auditing and reporting on tax increment, annually prepares a report. They also have newsletters and guidelines. The report looks like this if you want to see, you know, statistics on individual city uses and so forth, and you can go to it there. The slide shows the link. With that, I'll stop unless there are questions so that you can move on to your...
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Michael. I do have a quick question regarding page 2, slide 3, okay. In which you describe TIF and the reasons for it. Seems to me that under the two bullet points there, the to induce development or redevelopment, is that related mostly to the private sector? Or would that be public sector development and redevelopment as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, it is really just, I think, purely or pretty much exclusively related to private sector development, because these need to be, in order for the mechanics of tax increment to work, they have to be taxable developments, because that's the only way you get incremental property taxes. And in fact, you know, a lot of tax increment, once you've induced the development, then you can use it to pay for public infrastructure elsewhere. That's where this pooling stuff comes in. And so I think you'll find that cities will use it initially to induce development, but then those extra revenues that they get above what they actually use to pay for that development, then they can use that to pay for sewer and water, streets elsewhere in the city. And that's where those percentage limits come in. But like I said before, you can't actually use it to pay for things like government buildings and so forth. But the theory really is private development and associated public infrastructure for that development. But the actual rules and operation allow more flexibility than that.
If I could follow up. Thank you, Mr. Michael, Madam Chair.
Barrett.
And under financing public improvements, that seems to relate to the public sector as well, I believe. If that's true, to what extent do, if you could put a percentage on the private sector versus the public sector investments in this program, what would you, how would you characterize that? In other words, to what extent do we invest in the private sector as opposed to public sector as it relates to TIF?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, I know of no, I mean, if I were to throw out a percentage, it would be a wild guess. The reporting on how the tax increments are spent, you know, basically, you can see the amount that's spent for infrastructure versus, I believe, versus land acquisition, although it's not clear on the write-down side how much that is. The lack of clarity, though, comes because some of these public infrastructure spending items in the normal course of events for an unassisted private development would actually be paid for by the private developer. So in other words, they might be specially assessed, or they might just bear the cost themselves. And so there's, just with the way the numbers are reported, there's really no way, and probably in theory, there probably wouldn't be any way either to sort of break down, well, what would the private development have paid, and what would the government have paid? I think, you know, there's a fair amount of, I think one way to focus on this would be how much money is pooled and used sort of away from the development. But some of that may also be used to induce private development. So I guess it's a long way of saying I can't answer your question.
Yeah, Representative Baird, another follow-up?
Yeah, just one more follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think it's fair to say that we as a branch of government and legislature feel a need to invest in the private sector because the private sector creates jobs and produces economic development. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, I would say that the tax increment law, implicit in its structure and purpose, assumes that it's appropriate for local governments to assist private development, some of which is, you know, eliminating blight, some of which it is creating jobs, as you say. That's the, and in fact, they have to make findings on the economic development districts that, hey, this will create jobs in Minnesota or provide low and moderate income housing. So, yeah, I think that you could reach the conclusion that, yeah, that's sort of the fundamental, one of the fundamental purposes of TIF is to create private sector jobs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Benson, did I see that you had a question?
I did not.
No, okay. Representative Lincheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, you know, just a comment on TIF since you took the time to do an overview. And, you know, I've talked to you, Madam Chair, about tax increment financing a little bit, and I, you know, really don't know your full philosophy on it, but I just want to lend my support to anything that you might be thinking to restrict this subsidy. It is a very controversial issue in the legislature. In fact, many legislators in both parties think it's just the greatest thing since sliced bread, and many of us think it's purely a hidden subsidy. It's a property tax increase, and in general, probably not the best idea for government to be involved in, and I think Representative Barrett's line of questioning just illuminated that. This is a transfer to, it's like many things in the tax code, it's a hidden subsidy, and it is really not government's purpose. But I know our local units of government all would like the free money that it provides. And so while I've been one who's been a strong opponent of these mechanisms, it certainly seems to be here to stay. But I do want to just, you know, maybe throw out there, and again, knowing it's controversial, I think we have about 2,000 TIF districts in the state of Minnesota, Madam Chair. And, you know, for any legislator who thinks, we feel the pressure as our mayors and council members come forward and say, will you carry this bill? And so legislators usually do. I mean, that's sort of our job. You know, we just do it as a courtesy. You know, some legislators really want them, some don't. But I just, as we go forward on this issue, this next biennium with you chairing this issue, Madam Chair, I just want to remind legislators and the public that the only reason you ever carry a bill is because you would like an exception from these rules. Okay, so the local units of government can do all the TIF they want under the current law. They only ask you to carry a bill when they would like to break one of these rules. So that's the only reason it ever comes before the state. We have a lot of legislators that don't serve on the tax committee who think the only way a city gets a TIF district is to come and get their legislator carrier. That's absolutely not true. They only bring a bill to you when they want a special exemption from the rules, which in my estimation are already pretty liberal. So I hope, you know, all of us will think long and hard about how much we really want to allow TIF to grow in this state. I hope, Madam Chair, that you will try to follow that trend downward that we saw. We saw this peak on the chart that Mr. Michael went through, and bipartisanly, tax chairs have worked diligently to get that trend downward. And why would we want to do that? You know, it raises people's property taxes. I mean, it's an inherent subsidy. It's got a lot of bad incentives that people can't see. So, for example, I used to be on our city council, and I know a whole bunch of people here used to be on locally elected, councils. And Representative Abrams, who chaired this committee, he was a Republican, for those who don't know him, he did that 2001 reform that we saw the slide drop down. What he did was he helped the state by saying, we are no longer going to pay the school portion of the TIF district. We are going to get out of the business as a state of subsidizing TIF by making up for the loss that the school districts lose when they lose their property tax base due to these developments. So that was a great move, in my estimation. Now we have a situation where if you're an elected council member, you know, you can totally understand why council members do these. So you're the council member of City X, and you have this much tax base, and you can only give this development this much tax base. But TIF allows you to grab the whole county's tax base. That's what's really going on here. So in my city, I get Bloomington's tax base and all of Hennepin County to give to the development. So, you know, there's this no accountability. The county commissioners, they can't really do anything about it. The cities are sort of spending their tax base. It's off the public review. It's not in truth and taxation statements. It's not on the property tax statements. And so we have this going on all over the place. And, you know, I really hope we'll really think about this. You know, the pooling piece, Representative Barrett was just talking about that. I mean, this is sort of the sugar daddy provision, in my estimation, where, you know, I wish our state didn't even do that, because it says, you know, we're going to give you incentive to do this thing over here, but, you know, after that's done, you can take the money and build this over here. You know, unrelated. So, you know, I do think there's just a lot of issues here. If, Madam Chair, you choose in this committee to lead an effort to reduce classification rates, which I heard you, as we heard the 55 classification rates, you know, you were commenting about simplicity, and, you know, there are states that have won. So if you compress those rates, you're going to hear from the TIF folks that, hey, you know, you're making it worse for us because you're compressing rates. And I hope that you can, you know, do your best. I think the pressure is enormous. Mr. Michael talked about the jobs bill. I carried that bill that loosened some of the rules, and in part because I wanted to call the bluff of the claim, saying, look, you're all saying if you could just have some freedom, you'd just build everything, you know. There were some proposals that went forward due to the jobs legislation in this regard. You know, a lot of it was just claims. And so now we're going to hear from folks who would like the state to get, you know, local governments to give them free tax base, that you just have to extend that. And I hope you will not do that. This is a hidden subsidy for all of our residents, and I hope we'll think long and hard about it. I just think there's so much here that legislators, as they get into the weeds, kind of fall asleep reading about this stuff. And it's complicated and it's pretty dry, but it affects every single one of us. Our residents are paying these taxes. And the way to think about this is, if we did TIFs for homes, you know, this would be how it's worked. Okay, you know, Representative Marquardt's house is worth this. And, you know, he would now like to put on an addition and all new windows and a better driveway to get to his house and access and better lighting. And so if he does that, he's going to pay an increased tax over time due to improvements to the property. If he had TIF, he could just say, you know what, I want to pay those taxes to myself because I want better windows. And so that's how it works. You capture the new increased value and you give it to yourself. And so what does that mean for everybody else who lives in Representative Marquardt's town? When he should be paying more tax due to his in his better improvements, he's not. So everybody else in that area either pays higher taxes or gets less government as a result of this. So I hope, you know, people will think long and hard, not about carrying the bills for their communities, because we all do that. But in the end game, this committee has to decide if it's going to sort of move that trend line back up to subsidy or go back down. And I just think we're at a point as a state and for our taxpayers, we just can't afford to have our residents subsidize this any longer. And I appreciate that you've given me the time to just think about the issue.
Thank you, Representative Chesky, for your perspective. Representative Barrett, did you have a... I'm sorry, McDonald, you were next.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Nelson, I hope that, I hope that this group that we can legislate and open up more TIF districts and allow cities to be more, have more advantage to loosen up some of the restrictions. Just speaking from experience from the city of Delano and Wright County, the counties that I represent, for the last 23 years as a businessman in Delano and 10 years on the city council, TIF districts have brought in so much great new businesses to the city of Delano, and after that TIF district expires, brought in much anticipated tax revenue for not only the schools, which need the tax base, the cities, and then the county as well. So my experience in TIF districts, and especially rural Minnesota, which I represent, have done such great things for our communities in bringing in industry, businesses, and getting rid of plighted areas that we can have a new tax capacity. So boy, I'm not sure what you're seeing on your end. You're more experienced, Representative Vanchesky, in this area, but I'm telling you, at a local level, it has done wonders for the cities and the school districts and the counties in bringing in businesses, jobs, and great tax revenue. I have not seen it, so I'm just telling you, from the rural perspective, from the small town perspective, TIF has been wonderful for councils and mayors to bring in businesses, bring in jobs, bring in tax base, and offer incentives for businesses to come to your community. And then after the TIF district expires, of course, you can imagine if you have a $2 million building, the tax capacity for the school districts, the county, and the city is great. And the jobs alone are, of course, bringing more revenue. So that's my experience, and it's been wonderful for communities. I'd hate to see the legislature to restrict it and make it even less an opportunity for cities and businesses to prosper. Thank you,
Members,
Madam Chairman.
We need to move on here. I don't know, was there one more comment from Representative Barrett?
I did have a quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to possibly clarify some information that I might have said that caused Representative Vanchesky to come to the conclusion that TIFs are hidden subsidies. In no way did my talk suggest that, and I'd like to point that out for the record. In fact, quite the opposite. My only point was trying to clarify or expose the fact that the public sector, i.e. the legislature, has found a great desire to make sure they invest in public private sector jobs because they lead to a growth in the economy. And so that was my only point with my testimony. Is that right or wrong with the TIF? We have, over time, said that private sector is where we want to invest. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We're going to move on to Bill. We're going to take up here today, and Representative Lemire with House File 12, Green Acres. So we invite you to welcome to the committee, Representative Lemire. And we understand there's been quite a bit of work, background work and previous committee work done on this bill.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Appreciate the work of everyone. And I believe you have an amendment that you wanted to present to get the bill in the shape it needs to be. And that
yes.
would be A-19. Representative Lemire moves the A-19 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, I move the author's amendment, A-19, so we can get the bill in its proper form.
All right. Do you want to give us an explanation of that?
Pardon me?
Did you want to explain that a little bit for us?
That's a technical amendment. It mainly just makes the language more clear to those that are interpreting it.
Okay. Representative Lemire has moved the A-19 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, A-19 passes. All right. And now, do you want to give us a presentation then of your bill, Representative Lemire?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I would first like to thank you for this opportunity to be here before you and the committee today. We had two committee sessions and two work sessions in the drafting of this legislation. And I'd like to acknowledge the fact that we had the input from the Minnesota Department of Labor, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, the farm organizations, testimony from farmers, Representative Eakin and his caucus, and the members of my own caucus who all assisted in the crafting of this legislation. It passed unanimously through the Agricultural Committee, and all of these individuals support this legislation. What House File 12 does is it mainly deals with the Rural Preserve Program. It eliminates the 8-year covenant, and it removes the conservation assessment that were needed in the previous legislation. Any green acres land that's enrolled after May 1st, 2012 will have a 5-year clawback instead of a 3-year clawback. Those that were previously in the program and who enroll in the program prior to May 1st, 2012 will have a 3-year clawback. Property owners that remove their eligible land from the green acres since 2008 because of frustrations regarding the covenant conservation plan and overall confusion surrounding the changes will be allowed to have their property reinstated in the green acres program at their request. And the county must, if there was a clawback that was paid back, the county must repay that clawback. And we created a purpose. Representative Eakin felt it was, and actually the Office of Administrative, the legislative auditors thought it was important for us to create a purpose with the Green Acres program. And we also required the Minnesota Department of Revenue along with the Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota to, and Minnesota assessing auditors, as well as the farm organizations to determine a methodology of determining land values in the agricultural 2A and 2B land. Madam Chair, members, I have concluded my remarks. I would like the opportunity to have testimony on, in support of House File 12 at this time.
Okay, Representative Lemire, did you want to call your witnesses to the table? Welcome, sir, and give us your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the government director with the Minnesota Farmers Union, and Minnesota Farmers Union supports House File 12 and appreciates the work of Representative Lemire and the members of the House Ag Committee in putting together this bill. We do support removing the covenant and removing the need for the assessment plan. Our members weren't really comfortable with the need for the plan or the covenant by and large. A lot of it came down to the average age of a farmer being 57 to 60 years old in a lot of those areas, and the differences between the cost and makeup of the plan. And also that this legislation gets us back to what we hear a lot from our members, and that in the old Green Acres, the idea was that a farm was a farm, and that's what we tried to get back to, and this legislation gets us back closer to what we hear from our members that a farm is a farm. So thank you.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And Mr. Raddatz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Raddatz. I'm Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. We want to thank Representative Lemire for authoring this legislation, and we are in full support of it. As he mentioned, the House Ag Committee spent a lot of time working on it and came out of there with a bipartisan package. Actually, our policy is to repeal Green Acres, the changes to Green Acres, which many of you have talked about and supported. But when we talk to our members and farmers, landowners, what they're really saying is we want things to go back to the way they were before 2008, when we had one program. We had the legislative auditor's report. There were concerns raised at that time. I think there was good legislative support on the fact that tillable land, productive agricultural land, should qualify for Green Acres. And in fact, it still does. There was concern, though, about the non-productive, the Class 2B land, and how that should be treated. And I think there was recognition that it made sense to offer some tax program for those type of lands. Thus, the Rural Preserve Program was created. But as Mr. Peterson said, the addition of the covenant and the management plan caused landowners to not be interested in enrolling in that program. And with these changes, we will get as close to as we were back in 2008. And then with the addition of the increased clawback for newly enrolled property, that is something that we can live with, I guess is the best way to say it. And I think the other important piece to remember in the summary of the bill, that only land that was properly enrolled in Green Acres, or that is an ag homestead, can qualify for these programs. So that puts some tightness around properties that can qualify. So we'd urge the committee to pass the bill on to the next stage. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any questions at this point? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members, and Mr. Raddatz and Mr. Peterson. I appreciate your work over the years on this issue. And you know, it all kind of came about when the Office of Legislative Auditor came out with the report. You know, and they listed several things, and you've mentioned some of those too. And one of the things was that, you know, what was the real intent of the program? Was it just to equalize tax base and farmland, or was it to preserve agricultural land? And who was to benefit from it? Was it supposed to be productive ag land, or was Green Acres to apply to non-productive ag land? And there was really a lot of inconsistencies. 35 of the 87 counties weren't even offering the program, even though they had non-agricultural influences on ag property. In fact, I think 5 of the counties didn't even inform residents they had a program. And then you looked at the preservation. So at that time, we actually set up Representative Demmer and Representative Coonan out of the Property Tax Division work to put something together. And so my question is, and my fear always is with something like this, is, you know, just like local government aid, you know, when you're giving a preferential treatment, and where, like in the case of Green Acres, that, you know, shifts about $35 million of property taxes onto other people. And when you're looking at, you know, increasing property taxes by $3 billion in tough economic times and so forth, I mean, you've got to take a look at these programs. And I guess my concern is that if we're going to have a long-term viable plan, that it has to be based on sound foundation, which means the formulas or whatever makes it tick has to be seen by everyone, whether or not you get Green Acres or not, whether or not you're a metro legislator or not, that in fact it's doing what it's intended and it's credible and you've got confidence in the system. And my concern is, when we kind of go back, I see us going back now to any type of kind of land is going to be eligible for Green Acres, and we were trying to fix that. My fear is that just as this has been kind of politicized the last couple years, and I might have a question for the author as to why we didn't do a repeal, because after our legislation in 2009, all I heard for a year and a half out in the districts and was, you know, repeal Green Acres, and, you know, and now we don't repeal Green Acres. I might want to know why we didn't, because that a lot of politicizing on that issue. But my concern is that this may, by doing this, where we really haven't made any headway as far as really some of the questions that OLA, and by the way, these reports are done after several legislators make the request. They don't just decide to do that on its own. It actually rises to the top of issues that legislators have. And personally, one of the reasons I wanted to address this and address the concerns here is because I want to see this program remain viable, doing what it's supposed to do with utmost confidence by all legislators. And my fear here, and I'll ask for your comments, is I don't think we've solved that. And we might come back in 5 years and it's politicized again, and it's changed again, and it may not be for the better of farmers around Minnesota. As our demographics change and our population changes and rural, metro, and so forth. So, Mr. Raddatz and Mr. Peterson, do you think the changes we're making here are going to give long-term confidence to members and viability to this program, or do you think we'll continue to politicize it?
Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, I want to thank you for your work on the issue over the years, too. It's kept everybody really busy. You have a lot of questions in there. I don't mean your work. I mean the issue itself. Oh, boy. You have a lot of questions, good questions, and you know, that's really the guts of the issue is the public policy debate on this. And as we've looked at it and worked on it, you know, we kind of go back and really the best that we can determine when it was first put in place back in the 70s, it wasn't to preserve ag land. What was happening, especially in the metro area, is developments were occurring outside of the city limits, let's say, so that farmers along the way were being assessed for sewer, roads, et cetera, that they weren't using necessarily. It was to the advantage of that development. So this program was put in place to kind of help them so they didn't have to pay those assessments. Really, if you look at the purpose statement in the legislation, I think it really captures what the program is. And what it really talks about is not preserving ag land, because if you remember, that's what the legislative auditor report said, that the program isn't effective at preserving ag land. But what we're looking at is a program that helps mitigate the property tax impact of increasing land values due to non-agricultural economic forces, which is what we think is the intent of the program and what it has done. And it's worked well over the years for that purpose. So I think that's important to look at, that we're heading down that road. The other thing with the repeal versus non-repeal, the concern we had, to be honest with you, is if we repeal, then we have the legislative auditor's report in front of us and we start over from square one. And I think even the changes made in 08 helped address some of those concerns that the auditor raised. And Mr. Peterson and I both at that time continually asked legislators, is this going to impact farmers and ag land? And the answer was no. And that's correct. If it was tillable land before 08, it was in green acres. After 08, it's still in green acres. What we didn't realize that in certain parts of the state, how much of a farm, how much class 2B property, as it became to be known, was part of that farming operation. And that's really what created a lot of the concerns that were raised and why people, as I said earlier, let's repeal it, but they really meant we want to go back to 08. So I think with the changes to the Rural Preserve Program, those farmers, and I think the biggest, to me, how that impacts, it's not going to impact non-farmers necessarily. What it impacts is those farmers who have a lot of Class 2B land on their property. Before 08, that was all considered green acres. Legislative Auditor Report said, you know, this is for ag land, and you've got this non-ag land that's in the program. That's why the other program was created. As far as the shift goes, yes, that's out there. You can't deny it. But I think, we would make the argument that in a lot of these areas, there is a desire to have farmland, open space, and those kind of activities. And there is a cost with that. And this is a way for all folks that live in that area to help shoulder some of that so that that farmer can continue to keep his farm in a farming operation and not sell it for development. So I maybe I didn't answer all of your questions, but
can
I add one? I'll listen and then come back. Yeah,
and then real quick too, and I understand the shift too. We've talked about that with our members. I carried around this big spreadsheet that I think then Chair Lincheski had that showed each county and the shift, and we visit with people about that. And I think what Mr. Raddatz said about, you know, that's what we'll say is when we're living out in those areas is part of trying to maintain a viable farming operation. There are a couple of things I, you know, thought about this a lot, Representative Markowski, Marquardt, is I think one other big change I've seen is the assessors have made a big change maybe they can talk to that, in the parcels that they've identified since 2008 that don't qualify for green acres. And that I think they've done a good job of going back and looking and saying, too, that a lot of these parcels don't qualify. I always have to quantify the calls I get from people, and I try to break down, okay, what does your property look like? In a lot of cases, that people didn't have 10 acres that were, they might have had 30 acres, but they haven't had any income off that for years. You know, they might have liked to or something, but they really weren't producing anything. And I think the audit, the assessors have done a good job of doing that. We, you know, and we were concerned about seeing farmers making the decisions, too, where they're, taking down trees, clearing woodlots, and we do start to see that. I live in Pine County. I drive through Chisago County every day, and I know some of them I see right now is a big project going on where the people are concerned about being removed out of green acres, and so that's important. And then also the study, Representative Marquardt, in the back, too, that we're trying to work on the value. So I do think we're moving in a positive direction.
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I do appreciate, you know, working with Mr. Raddatz and Mr. Peterson. You guys have been great proponents for ag. And I, you know, at the same time, you know, if you kind of go back a little bit, initially the 2A and the 2B, when we were talking about the 2B, the rural vacant land, it actually was separate from green acres initially. It initially came about because people were coming in from the Twin Cities and buying up ag land for hunting in that, and they'd pay $4,000 or $5,000 an acre versus the ag price of, you know, $1,200 to $1,500 an acre, and yet they'd have to, the assessors would have to take the sales ratios, and it was driving up ag land. So we thought, well, let's separate the two, so then it won't impact the ag land, and then at the same time we did the green acres. So sometimes but at that time it was to try to help the ag land, and then also at that time, and you guys were big proponents, we lowered the classification rate on that first tier of homestead from 0.55 to 0.50, which was about a 9% decrease, everything else being equal. So that was good. The one portion, and maybe this is something we really need to look at, is the preservation. And you know, as you say, it probably wasn't the intent of the program. And in the fastest growing areas, like the Twin Cities, there's been about an 18% loss of farmland. And according to the report, like Anoka County, 26% from 1982 to 97 when they did lost the farmland. And you can see why that could be, because, you know, the amount that someone may pay for development per acre is greatly going to overcome any penalties of clawbacks or anything like that. Just as a quick example to put it in perspective, in Isanti County, the difference now, because we've had such a strong ag market, you've got the highest and best use, which would be the non-agriculture influence, and then you've got the green acres value here. Well, because ag land has increased much faster than the other ones, and here's the benefit is between here, we're to here. And in fact, some info I've got from the Department of Revenue in Isanti County, the highest and best use right now is 3,000. And the green acres is 2,800 an acre. That's only 200 difference. And then the year before, it was like 900 difference. So you look at that, on an, if it's homestead, if you've got $1,000 difference, or let's say $200 difference, that's right now only a green acres benefit of $1 an acre. So if you've got a quarter section of land, that benefit right now is only $160. So let's say you got the 3-year clawback or the 5-year, that's like $800. And you know a developer's going to just come in and pay much, much more. So I guess if my concern is preserving ag land, you know, have you got ideas on how we can really do that? Because in the rural areas, in my area, it's not a big concern. It just isn't, there isn't a market and you're not losing much farmland. But in the fast-growing areas down here, you are. And so do you see anything on, I mean, should green acres be extended into there, and is there something we can do with the preservation?
Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, there is a Metro Ag Preserve Program.
Right.
I'm not an expert on that, and I don't know the details of that, but that might address your concern of a program that is designed more as a long-term preservation program. And I'm sure there's others in the audience that can give us more details on that. The other comment I'd make, too, is as far as looking to the future, is this going to make some changes and we're not back here next year again? The big difference I've seen this year that we didn't maybe have in the past legislation was passed, and then Revenue implemented it, and then the assessors were on the ground doing it. In the last 2 weeks, throughout all these discussions, we've had revenue at the table and assessors at the table and legislators. So when we look at the legislation, then revenue says, well, this is how it's going to work from the state revenue department, and then the assessors are at the table saying this is how it's going to work in the counties. And I would agree with Mr. Peterson, the assessors have done a lot of work in this classification area over the last couple of years, and I think we're a lot closer, so we don't have to have this debate about what the legislative intent was a year from now. I think we're a lot closer to being all on the same page on how these changes will work and impact the program.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I'd like to hear a little discussion about the trade-offs here, because I think whenever we enact a public policy that gives any group, whether it's TIF like we talked about earlier, this program, somebody a tax break, it's usually because they're serving a broadly recognized public purpose, and it's worth enough that everyone else in that community is willing to pay more to give that public purpose an advantage. And this one is going to shift, according to the Department of Revenue, $800,000 of taxes onto other people who live in the same school district, the same county, the same, you know, area. And the trade-off, to my perspective, has been the long-term commitment, which was always said was the purpose of this, was we want to maintain this lifestyle. We want to maintain ourselves as farmers. We want to preserve the land. And it's hard to do with all that development pressure around us. So we ask in exchange for a really big tax break, an 8-year commitment, which to me is not long term. 8 years is like a blink. I mean, and so you're getting rid of the 8-year commitment. And there was a covenant and an assessment plan that said, in exchange for this big tax break, we're going to treat the land right, and we're going to work with our Soil and Water Conservation Board, and we're going to put together something that says to everyone in this community, we're doing right by the land, which is, I think, what everyone expects of farmers, and I think why they're valued and cherished. And so it's hard for me to look at this proposal and say, we're going to give you the tax break. And in fact, if you dropped out of the program and you want to go back in history, we'll even refund the money, which is a unique sort of thing. But we're going to give you the break with absolutely no real commitment to the community that you're going to preserve the land, that you're going to treat it right, and that you're going to be there 8 years. 8 years, and if you it doesn't say you're locked in for 8 years. It just says if you decide in year three that the developer offered you a better deal, you just pay it back. I don't understand why Representative Lemire, why you're removing that partnership, because to me, that's the trade-off. And that's how you explain it to the people who live in that school district who aren't farmers, and the people who are sitting in town, you know, who are paying their county taxes, that they're getting something for picking up the tax bill of their neighbors.
Representative Lemire, is it a little bit of a social contract, I mean, between the town folks and the farmers, and this is an understanding and a partnership that
the covenant?
That they've grown to accept and appreciate.
Well, the 8-year covenant that the farmer would have to agree to, they wouldn't be able to touch their land. They have to do a conservation assessment, taking aerial photos, and all these extra steps in order to receive the same benefits that they were receiving, which they got kicked out of. And we feel that making both the 2A and 2B property, the Rural Preserve Program and the Green Acres Program, if you make it similar, it'll be easier for the assessors and the counties to implement also. And to your point about, agriculture is one of the economic engines that drives our economy. It's one of the top exporters in the country. It's a billion-dollar industry for the state of Minnesota. And I believe if we can do this little thing to help preserve the farming industry, the agriculture industry, to keep it vibrant and successful, it does benefit the whole state of Minnesota.
Representative Loeffler?
Madam Chair, but I'm confused, Representative Lemire, because this to me doesn't keep it vibrant when we're only asking for an 8-year covenant and we're not asking them to treat the non-ag land, the non-tilled land, in a way that's respectful of the land. And so I don't know how this contributes to that. And the question is, not is it a benefit to that ag property owner, but what is the benefit to the person who lives in town a half a mile away, who's got a small, modest house and is struggling to pay their county taxes and their school district taxes and their township or city taxes. And now their taxes are going to go up because we're loosening up the expectations on ag land in that community. And what would that farmer, if they were forced to go to a public hearing on this in that community, be saying to that struggling family who's in that home in town that they're getting in exchange for giving a break to someone down the road? And in law, what we have right now is an 8-year commitment and a plan for managing the land in a responsible way. And that, to me, is a minor trade-off for a pretty big tax break. I have to tell you, and so I'd really like to have you go back, Representative Lemire, to explain to me again, what is the trade-off after we would pass your bill that would say to that family in town that they are getting a benefit by absorbing increased taxes that otherwise would have gone to the ag property with a higher expectation?
Madam Chair?
Representative Lemire?
I believe that the tax implication, whether in the conservation program or the rural preserve program, it's the same. So it's not going to be any more detrimental to the same individuals that you're talking about. It's just that it's an 8-year covenant which says that the farmers can't touch it, and then they have to sign a conservation assessment, which, as we know, the farmers are the original conservationists. We just thought all that extra paperwork and all that extra filing fees was unnecessary, and we wanted to make the program reflect the Green Acres program. So that was the main reason that we did the changes.
Did either Mr. Raddatz or Mr. Peterson wish to?
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, another thing too, to for some of the newer people on the committee too, but is just to consider where the Green Acres area is. I don't know if you all have the legislative audit report. I saw Representative Marquardt holding up the map there, but really starting down in what we call it really follows like the dairy areas from Minnesota. So we start in the southeast corner in Fillmore, Houston County, go up to Winona, up to the Twin Cities, kind of go north up to Chisago and Isani County, out west a little bit towards McLeod County, take a hard left up to Stearns County and into Otter Tail County. And those are obviously the areas that face pressure, but it's also where all the dairy farms are in Minnesota. It's also where a lot of the local food are growing, where farmers are trying to make a living on those small parcels, and it's difficult. Those are smaller parcels that face outside pressures. The other thing too is I think when people move to rural areas, that's one of the trade-offs for moving to a rural area. And whether you're moving out to Sani or Cambridge, is a reason people chose to live there and move there. And I've asked legislators from both sides of the parties of this when they're out door knocking. Maybe people in town don't always think about it, that they're getting a tax break, but you don't always hear that people like living in the rural areas. They like having that those characters of the farms and acreages in those areas. And so I do understand the trade-off, but what concerned me is with the covenant and the plan is we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing farmers not be good conservationists. We're seeing them not use their, deciding to make, decisions because they can put the land back in Green Acres. We can take that non-productive land or the land in the Rural Preserve Program instead of putting in the Rural Preserve Program. And I don't want to do the covenant. I'm 60 years old. I don't know what I'm going to do. Let's fence it in put it back in cropland. And that's something that we didn't like to see. We didn't like the plans varied. It was another thing we saw between counties. When we were talking about the plan in conference committee last year, we were talking about a one-page simplified plan. And some counties, that was the case. And other counties were hearing of a 3-4-page plan with a $100, but then $3-4 per acre capped at $500. And that was, and the different things that you'd need to have in the plans concerned a lot of the farmers. And so they were choosing not to make that decision. And so those were some of the reasons.
And Representative Loeffler, did that satisfy your question?
Oh, no, Representative Renbeck, and to our guests, I don't feel like you're answering the question, which is what is the value to the non-ag property owner? And if you take away the covenant, I mean, 8 years is nothing. And I keep hearing you say, well, people are 60 years old. They don't know what they want to do. So they want to sell it to a developer because they want to cash in the millions of dollars or the thousands of dollars or whatever value they've got. And so without the covenant, I mean, they could just start laying out the streets and start planting the trees in the front yards because they're going to cash out. I mean, it doesn't say, I mean, without a conservation plan, there's no obligation that you're not going to just be saying, hey, don't make me pay increased value for my value. And I have to say, we had an extensive hearing about this earlier, and we have to talk about tax fairness. This is not a small deal. We had someone who brought in their tax statements and voluntarily shared them around the table. And this was someone who was upset with his double-digit tax increases, and I think a lot of us have heard from property owners who are upset with double-digit increases. I certainly have. And the collective, he had like seven or eight statements. I added them up. I got a calculator, added them up. I ran upstairs. This property, not even including the homestead, he didn't give us his homestead statement, but his green acres land, I added up owning huge amounts of Washington County land. He was paying less than the couple that lives across the street from me in an 800-square-foot two-bedroom house. And so this is not a small deal. This is a huge tax break. And for that couple who have a two-bedroom, 800-square-foot house, I have to be able to explain to them that when we give a huge tax break to someone who's in a business, that we as a state and the taxpayers, not even just in that community where we're shifting burdens, but we as a state are actually looking at equity and fairness. And it's really hard when to see tax statements that just made my jaw drop. And I'm willing to accept that we have inequities because we value farming and we value certain things over other things. But I really believe that the covenant and an eight-year promise is minimal if we're going to fulfill the goal, which is to preserve ag as a viable industry in our state. And I'm willing to step up and preserve ag as a viable industry and to make sure that the surrounding non-ag around that farm is land is treated well and is a habitat resource. Because my people really value preserving habitat and treating the land well. And they honor the farmers who do that. Okay. But I think we need to have a trade-off here, and this bill takes away all accountability for any kind of community and state benefit for the tax benefit, and I just am real uncomfortable with that. And so telling me where the land is doesn't help. To me, the basic question is, what is the state purpose? That what is the purpose that is great enough that everyone else in that county should pay more? And what is the purpose that I can explain to that couple who's struggling with a several thousand-dollar tax bill for 800 square feet to give the break?
I don't know if you want to respond, but we want to. I think we heard Representative Loeffler, and perhaps we will keep going to other comments unless you want to respond.
All I just want to say is, you know, the USA has a cheap food policy, and if we tax farms at the same level that they can't afford to farm.
Yeah. Okay. we have some amendments, and we have Representative Lucheski. I don't know if you wanted to start with your amendments.
Well, no, Madam Chair, I just, you had asked, were there any questions of the testifiers, and unless you're not taking them anymore, I don't know if there's more testifiers. I did want to address something to the testifiers.
Right. Well, if we have to come back, we'll come back. So if you have questions.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And I appreciate the frustration, contrary to what folks who were not here before may not know, is we actually had hours and hours and hours and hours of testimony on these committee issues and so it's not, you know, it's not a kind of really a 90-minute issue, and it's a very complicated issue, and everyone in the state has to care, because what a lot of people don't understand is that everybody's got some green acres. I have green acres in my district. It's in Bloomington. So, and in fact, the one of the pieces of land in green acres in my district has been able to avoid $20 million in market value while they've been in green acres. So my residents pay for that. So
is that the exception? I mean, I think there's a particular property we all know about, right? It's
well,
really
the whole
exception.
You know, it's everywhere in the state. I mean, and if you have not read this, I know we've got our packets. I don't know who's, you know. I mean, the net effect of this program is to raise everybody else's property taxes. So there are higher and lower amounts, but in market value, the big price tags is in the county. In the metro. That's where it's the collar counties and the land use development pressure. You might have more parcels. You might have more acres. But in market value, so now we're talking how many millions of value are you holding off the tax rolls? It's here. And so, you know, folks have to, every legislator should care about the policy. I mean, granted, some of us in the metro don't have to worry about the politics. And rural members, I understand that bipartisanly have to worry about the politics. But we should all care profoundly about the policy. And I guess what I want to say to the folks who are talking here, you know, the question that I think isn't getting answered, and I heard Mr. Radzik say, you know, we understand that locally we're asking other people to shoulder the burden. That's exactly right. That's exactly what's going on here. And so while folks may have large acreage of land, you have to look at, okay, who are your residents? And we all have the same size legislative districts. I think the biggest, the district with the most farms is about 1,800 farms. So there is no one in the state of Minnesota who doesn't have mostly non-farmers. No one. And I know, I heard Representative McDonald say he lives in Delano, and I drive through Delano all the time. I have family in Buffalo, and you have a beautiful community. And I thought about, when you mentioned Delano, I mean, Delano, that area is a kind of a classic example where all the homeowners there are going to pick up the property taxes for the farmers. And you drive right through and you see them. It's still a very small percentage of the people who live in Representative McDonald's district. I think it's under 1,000. So you have 40,000 residents. And so those other folks are all going to pay these people's property taxes. And that might be a legitimate policy, but that is what we need to hear. Why should that be? And I guess I'd like to know, you know, we already have farmers kind of paying the lowest effective tax rates in the state. And what gets lost in the debate, Mr. Representative Marquardt just said, and people need to hear this, we simultaneously cut the classification rates for farmers. Their homeowners pay 0.1, farmers were already only paying 0.55, and we made them pay only 0.5. You got a huge tax cut just for being a farmer. And then on top of it, this green acre. So, you know, I do think people have to think about, you know, how they're going to justify that the effective tax rates for homesteaded farms is 0.39 right now. The effective tax rates for ag non-homestead is 1.0, and homeowners are 1.08. So already, you know, we can see who's getting the best deal. So I do think we need to get an answer to that question. Why should everybody else in the property tax system shoulder the increased property taxes for this program?
If I could comment on that, Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski. In the last 2 years, the only class of property that's really increased in value in the state of Minnesota is ag land. I think in 2009 it went up 35%. And it paid 12 to 15% more in property taxes. The property taxes paid by ag land, I believe, went up 12 to 15% compared to any other class of property. It's in a Department of Revenue study that was released, if I have the figures correct. If I don't, I'll get those correct figures. But there was a shift in the last 2 years of the total property taxes paid, a shift to ag land, away from other properties because those properties haven't gone up in value.
Well, Madam Chair, but that shifts back over time. So, Madam Chair, that's not my issue. Time changes. I mean, values go up and down. We get that. We don't give people, like, green acres when their home values go up compared to all the other properties. We don't give businesses a program for when their values are rising. You know, we do have something for all homeowners, and this includes farmers, called targeting. So if your taxes are going up fast, everybody qualifies for this in the state of Minnesota. Farmer, homeowner, millionaire. Everybody qualifies for targeting, which means if your property taxes go up by $100 or 12% in 1 year, we don't care who you are, you get a tax break. Farmers, homeowners, multimillionaires. This is on top of that. So I'll just leave it at that, Madam Chair, because I know you want to move on, but I don't think this question's getting answered as to what's the public policy of giving everyone a tax break at the expense of everyone else.
Mr. Raddatz.
If I could do that, I would point again to the purpose that's in the legislation. It's to preserve farms, or to encourage and preserve farms by mitigating the property impact, property tax impact of increasing land values due to non-agricultural economic forces. It's to allow farmers to continue to be able to farm to produce the food and fuel and fiber that we have. Secondly, we're talking about farmland that doesn't require as many of the services that a residential property would require.
Okay, I think we have another question from Mr. Representative Benson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, preface this by saying I'm new to the committee. I was raised in rural Minnesota, and in fact, I'll come out and admit I have been endorsed by Minnesota Farmers Union. My father was a very active member in Freeborn County, and but I left agricultural community because I wanted to get more wealthy, so I became a school teacher. which shows you how limited elementary education was in my two-room school back in rural Minnesota. Well, you know, so I spent some time teaching history, and you know, I don't want to pick on Thomas Jefferson too much, because he is considered, you know, the founder of the Democratic Party, but he had this debate with Alexander Hamilton and the Federalists about the value of agricultural society versus the evil big cities and technology and industry and all that. And so we've had this philosophy which never dies, even though the rural population is down to what, 2-3% now as far as those who actively farm. We still have this romantic view of agriculture, and I do believe in rural America. But at the same time, I have a real problem in understanding why the government, in this case, chooses to pick winners and losers. It seems to me that if my parents had not bought property somewhere between Austin and Albert Lea, but had been smart and purchased some property in Chanhassen, and the value of that property had gone from several thousand an acre to maybe a million or two, why in a capitalist society where we believe that you make investments and that capital flows to those activities which are most conducive to economic growth, why someone owning a property of several million dollars would want to continue to grow beets or corn or wheat and not, in a sense, cash in so that that property could, in fact, produce greater wealth? So to me, I understand the concern here for maintaining rural America, but I think the point being made here that we have this lingering love of rural America, and that we're prepared, I guess, apparently, to have the majority of the population pay for this mythology, which continues. And I'm sorry, Thomas Jefferson, you were a very smart fellow, and I love the Declaration of Independence, but you were wrong on economic policy. Alexander Hamilton was right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Were there any responses to that? The table? Okay. First, we have Representative Mahoney. You'll line up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, to echo my good friend from the suburbs, I'm new to this committee. And I've tried to read. I mean, I'm floored by the amount of reading I'm supposed to do in taxes.
Come to human services.
And I'm kind of trying to get my arms around this. So I'll break this down to a very simple question. For a good number of years, I have colleagues that I've worked with, friends that I've recreated with, that have told me, yeah, I'm in Green Acres. I've got a half-acre garden that my kid sells produce out of, and then, we ride the horse, and we've got a goat, and, and boy, my property taxes are a third of what yours are in the city. Are we going back to that? So I have to like put duct tape over my mouth so I don't tell my friend he's my friends and colleagues that they are stealing from me. I mean, I don't want to aggravate the farmers because I understand the cheap food policy that we have in the United States. I get that part. But I certainly don't want the guy that has moved out to the rural areas so he can avoid a few things in the metro area, and then I actually have to pay for it. So is that, are we going back to that?
Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, no, I don't think we are. I think that some of the things I talked about earlier with the assessors have done a really good job. I hope we hear from them later. They are doing a much better job of identifying properties and who is a farm. You do have to have 10 acres to be in Green Acres. You do have to have a product for sale on your farm. And so I think they are looking at that quite a bit. I also think that this does provide some exciting opportunities. We just got an email this morning. We're trying to work with some of the Hmong farmers in your area that from your district that are trying to go out and try to buy and try to get land in, say, Dakota, Scott County, and try to find these affordable parcels. There's a lot of, I think last year we had 100 farmers on the waiting list that wanted to come out and purchase land, and that's a real growing trend, a real growing thing that they'd like to do. But having that affordable property for them to farm and the owners to allow them to farm and work with them, this Green Acres legislation does allow that too, and so I encourage you to support.
Representative Hamilton, did you wish to come to the witness table, answer that question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Lincheski's question, and also to Representative Mahoney's comment, you're absolutely right. In the United States, we do have a cheap food policy. And so your question, why do we do this, or yours as well, how do we explain this to the people in which we represent? Simply put, if we tax the farms in those areas at the same level, they can't afford to farm. And stop and ask yourself why we, your constituents, are able to pay only 10% of their disposable income to feed their families versus 50 in some of the other percent in some of the other countries. It's because we do have a cheap food policy. And those are the gives and give and takes here. And if you think it's scary, dependent on foreign oil, just wait till we're dependent on foreign food. This is a bigger item than just the sheer tax statement that we're debating on here today. And again, if we tax them at the same level, they can't afford it. They can't afford to operate. And so when you ask who is benefiting for all of this, I would argue that it's not, in the long run, it's not the farmer. It is the consumer. And therefore, I, if I could be so bold, I ask for your support to Lemire's bill. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just noticing the time, I thought maybe we should move to amendments, and I'd like to offer one, which is the A14 amendment. Mm-hmm. And this...
Representative Loeffler, we're going to have a couple more comments. And
okay,
we'll
whenever you're ready.
Amendments. So, Representative Peterson...
I'll pass. Thanks.
Okay, Representative Barrett.
I will pass as well.
All right, and Representative Conan, or is it Coonan?
Coonan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam
okay.
Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. See, I would just like to comment a little bit about the use of Green Acres and why it's important. Well, to farmers, but also to all of society, I think. Representative Demmer and I were the two people that kind of got this whole thing going, and so Representative Lemire, I want to commend you on your courage on taking on Green Acres.
Thank you.
But you know, Green Acres, there's a lot of different views around that. Minnesota is a state with a lot of variances in the lay of the land and the population around the state. And so depending upon who you talk to, there's a lot of different views on what Green Acres should be. Green Acres is important to family farmers who have established a farm, and a lot of times that we pass down generation to generation. And they could, when the farm was started, it was miles away from any metropolitan area or any development. And as time passed, the development moved in around their farm. And they never intended to view their farm as an investment that they're going to cash in on. They just wanted to continue farming. And with those new higher values of the farm being pushed up by the developer around them, the taxes would actually bring them into a situation where they couldn't cash flow or be able to continue to farm anymore. And so for those families, Green Acres is very important to keep the farm actually in production. Without that, they would be forced to sell and move elsewhere. And you could say, well, yeah, they can sell and probably even buy a bigger farm in other places. And this gets more to the social issue and how farms are viewed. I'm going to tell, I know we're getting short on time, but I got to tell a quick story here. Grandpa's on his deathbed, and he says, where's my son Jimmy? Oh, he's here. Everybody's here. Where's Johnny then? How about Susie and Emily? Where are all of them? Oh, everybody's here, Grandpa. Everybody's around the bed. And then Grandpa says, well, who's milking the cows? And what I'm trying to illustrate by that is that for a lot of farmers, the farm and family life are all one, so it's very important to them. And so I think that kind of points out some of the importance of Green Acres. Thank you.
All right, we're going to move on to amendments then. Did you have an amendment, Representative Loeffler?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the A14 amendment.
All right, Representative Loeffler offers the A14 amendment.
And
you want to address that?
Yes, we've kind of gotten far afield into what is the purpose and the philosophy of Green Acres, and this, let me just bring us back to what this exactly does. This does not get rid of the Green Acres program in any way. It doesn't pull it back from what it currently does. What it does remove from the bill is the dropping of the 8-year commitment and the need to file a conservation plan is kind of the heart of it. To me, that's the trade-off for giving the break to agriculture, which, you know, we've heard eloquent testimony to the value of it. But I think it retains the integrity and the accountability of the program to say that to get the Green Acres break, you have to commit to 8 years. If you don't, you can get out in 2 years. You just have to pay back some of the benefits. But that you also have to do a conservation plan. So it's just preserving the current expectation that in exchange for an advantage tax break, you do an 8-year commitment and a covenant. The only other thing it preserves in the bill the study. It preserves the purpose statement that's put in there, but it says in exchange for the break, we're going to continue to expect a conservation plan and 8-year commitment.
Representative Lemire, do you want to comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would encourage a no vote on this. It pretty much erases all the major changes that we have in HF 12. So please vote
any
no.
Any discussion? Representative Lischewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lemire, I too want to thank you for your courage. You know, Representative Marquardt and I, we were just handed the OLA report as we became tax chairs. And, you know, tax chairs have to deal with these. That's just how it is. And the findings in this is the program has lots and lots of problems. Lots of people try to fix the problems and then unfix some things, and now you're taking another stab at it. And I think, you know, for the viewers, you know, you have the majority. My guess is your bill's going to pass. I think you're going to do what you want to do. And that's a good thing when you're in the majority. In the minority, your job is to point out, you know, items that people may not be aware of and that people should understand as they go forward and pass these bills. And in this amendment, I guess I just want to say, Representative Lemire, Representative Hamilton's testimony that we just heard and Representative Coonan's testimony that we just heard, this amendment does not touch that. Those purposes that Representative Hamilton and Representative Coonan just talked about are all about 2A. That's where Green Acres is. That's what the deal is. That's the tillable land. 2B, which this amendment is addressing, where your bill repeals the covenant language and erases a conservation plan, is the non-farm land.
Yep.
So when Representative Hamilton, just for members, heard his testimony and Representative Coonan, they're talking about 2A. And all those goals that for, you know, cheap food and the family life and who's milking the cow and all those things we just heard, that's where 2A, that's where that all happens. 2B is the non-tillable, non-productive. And in fact, in the original legislation, we told assessors, if you can't really break the on the difference between 2A and 2B, you can call it all 2A. Because we got that the farm was a farm was a farm. And so that was in there. I think one of the net effects of this debate has been broad assessment, education, and reform. But what Representative Loeffler is now doing is saying in 2B, which is in the purpose statement of this bill, which I personally would, I think you might want to think twice about having a purpose statement because they come back to haunt you when they pass. But the purpose says we're going to preserve this land, you know. And, okay, so that's what the covenant language and the conservation plan language does. That's exactly what it does. When you pull that out, you don't even need 2A and 2B anymore. Just go back to all one classification, put everything in green acres again, and continue to have all the land that isn't productive to receive a tax benefit by everyone else. So, you know, Representative Lemire, maybe you can explain to us why in this amendment we preserve all of 2A as is the tillable language, and what the problem is in expecting that the taxpayers get a little bit of assurance for their tax subsidy in the non-productive land, that there'll be a covenant and conservation plan. And Representative Lemire, if you could help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
Did we want to have Representative Hamilton address that?
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lencheski, I understand your concern. It is because what you said, a farm is a farm. It is the income off the 2A land that would pay for the increased taxes on the 2B land. If the 2B land is not generating income, like I said, it is the 2A land, the tillable land, that would produce the income that would pay for the increased taxes on the 2B land. And so it comes right back to what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lencheski?
Well, Madam Chair, this bill is not about the farmer's income for the tax. It's about preserving the land. So this is a land issue. That's what a covenant is about. It's not, you know, the OLA report said you ought to define income better, and in fact we chose to not. We could go back to subpart F income if you want to get into income, but you take homeowners. We pay taxes on our dwelling and taxes on our land. And the fact that they're assessed differently is sort of irrelevant. I mean, I have agreements on my property. I am on a... I abut water, and so I can't put different kinds of pesticides on my land. I can't even put a garden in a certain part of an area. I have agreements environmentally that I can't get out of that I have to pay taxes on. If we're gonna get into income, that's really different than this bill.
So, and Madam
Chair, Hamilton?
And I understand the time, and I'll just reiterate: the farmers in the room will understand this. You have a set of land that you actually farm to get the income to pay for all your other expenses. And if you're separating out a segment of land here on the 2B side, it's going to put additional tax pressures on your 2A, the land that's actually providing a living for your family. A farm is a farm.
Representative Loeffler?
Madam Chair, I just think it's important for us before we vote for people to really understand this. This has nothing to do with what Representative Hamilton just discussed. This does not change the tax bill on any single piece of property. It does not do anything on the tax bill on the tillable versus the non-tillable. It just says that we want to preserve our current law, which is for the non-tillable land, the ponds and the forests and the wetlands, that we are going to continue to expect that for that to get a very advantaged tax break, that they will continue, as in current law, to make an 8-year commitment to keeping that land as it is, or pay a financial penalty if they choose not to, and that they will have a covenant and that's the commitment, and that they will have a conservation plan. So for the non-tillable, this just preserves current law that says to get that tax break, you file a conservation plan. I think that's a minimal expectation. I suspect it doesn't even cost that much to put one together. We've heard testimony that there's some of them are only one page. I think it's a minimal expectation. It does not change the tax obligation at all. And so I would urge a yes support. It's only about, that's the only thing it deals with.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair,
is that
if I could. In the revenue report by the Revenue Department, changing the program from getting rid of the covenant and putting it into the 5-year clawback, the 3-year clawback, it shows that it increases transparency, understandability, simplicity, and accountability. Mm-hmm. So again, members, I encourage a no vote on this, and if I could get a roll call vote.
Roll call's been requested. And the legislative assistant will take the roll. Representative Runbeck? No. Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Markport?
Yes.
Representative Barrett?
No.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Doubt?
No.
Representative Detmer?
No.
Representative Dittrich?
Yes.
Representative Coonan?
Yes.
Representative Lemire?
No.
Representative Lincheski?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney?
Yes.
Representative McDonald?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
We have 9 no's and 7 ayes. The amendment does not pass. We're going to recess, members, take up the remaining amendments, and recess to the call of the chair. So thanks very much. I don't know if we'll be tonight or just when we'll be. And the meeting is adjourned.
Nope.
Oh, I'm sorry. Meeting is recessed.